This is David McDowell, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 6th of July 2012.
My name is David William McDowell. I was born in Jersey on the 14th of February 1936.
So you're 76 years old then?
76, yes.
I detect an Australian strain.
Yes, since 1964, when I upped sticks and went to Australia, which I very much enjoyed.
You're still there?
I'm still there, yes, yeah.
Okay, might come to that later on. Tell me about your background. What did your father do?
My father was a maintenance engineer at a tea factory in Jersey. It was at Lyons Tea. And they used to sell this tea to South America, mainly to Argentina. Which is very odd, really, when you think it comes from Jersey, but they did that very well.
They grow tea bushes in Jersey?
No. They bought the tea from Ceylon or wherever and packaged it in Jersey, and then that was then exported to, say, mainly Argentina.
Was that your father's business?
No. He was a chief maintenance engineer there. He'd had... most of his life he'd been involved in the tea manufacturing side. But he did run a pub in Manchester in the wartime, and which was very interesting. And I was a young boy just living in this pub. I had a bedroom over the saloon bar, and all the smoke coming up and the people singing, you know, late at night. It was all good fun.
What part of Manchester was that?
Salford.
Oh yeah, okay.
It's pretty pretty rough.
So did you have a good education?
I went to Victoria College in Jersey. Sort of secondary school. It was the best college in the island, but that didn't really say a lot. But I never went on to any tertiary education, mainly because in the Channel Islands it's very difficult to, well, it was at that time, to get places, and I really didn't fancy it anyway. So I ended up in the Met Office, working for the Jersey government, and say that was a interesting time, working in a very busy airport.
Was that something you'd wanted to do, or was it just making the best of what was available?
Probably the latter, but I enjoyed it. You know, it was okay, but it was doing that job then really got me the qualification to be able to go straight down to the Antarctic. So in fact, it did serve a very useful purpose.
But that wasn't in your thinking when you applied to be a Met Man?
No.
So at what point in your life do you think you became aware of the fact that there was a place called the Antarctic?
Well, I think I looked at a map one day and there was the Antarctic.
But I suppose what I mean is, did you read about Scott and Shackleton? Did you see the film?
Not particular. Before going down south, I read a few books, because I thought it might be useful, but I didn't do any specific research or anything like that. I think I said in my notes that the reason I got interested in the Antarctic was because there was one of the weather magazines, there was a little ad used to appear, which offered jobs in the Antarctic for Met people. But to say it, I'm sure the word cold and snow and whatever never appeared in the ad.
What made you want to apply then, David?
I think it was, I was a young bloke. You know, I had my 21st birthday in the Antarctic. You know, I was very young and I was keen and... and it was just another thing to do. I really enjoyed it. It was good.
Were you surprised to get the job?
Or
perhaps you were too young to be surprised.
Well, I thought, no, I've never really thought of it like that. It wasn't hard to get, let's put it that way.
It was a bit of a cosy chat, was it, rather than
a proper interview? Yes, yes. Mm. Just a few little conversations with a few people, and so the fact that they didn't have to train me, because most of the people who go down the Antarctic as weather people in that day and age used to go off on a many week course to Dunstable, I think it was, where all they did with me was find a berth on a boat and send me south, you know, which was good.
How was it then when you got there?
Well, when I arrived, I was purloined from the off the boat to actually work in the Med office in Port Stanley, because there was a shortage of people there. So I worked for a few months in Port Stanley, which was quite interesting.
Well, what kind of things were you doing? Because were you just processing information coming in from the bases, or were you actually doing your own readings?
We were doing actually both of those. It was a weather observing station, and there was charts needed to be plotted, and there was radio sons that were sent up, and balloons. And I was involved in all of that. I mean, I knew how to plot a chart and things like that.
And were you also kind of organising the base, organising the office as well, rostering staff and so on?
Not in Stanley. No. When I got to the bases, my first base was at Signy. Mm. One of my duties was to organise the
draw up the rota.
Yeah, the rota, and you know, work out who's going to do what, when, and where, and make sure that people who were doing observations were doing it properly. And so it was just really a management exercise.
Let's go back to Stanley then. What was Stanley like in 58?
Ah, Stanley, yes. That was a good drinking town. there used to be I stayed at a little guest house, Mar Brecken's.
And, infamous.
Yes, and there was a... every Sunday, they put on quite a nice luncheon. That was put on at about 1 o'clock. Now, from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock, the pubs opened. And so we used to all rush down to the pubs and drink as many beers as possible in the shortest possible time, and then we would turn up for this meal, which I can never really remember too much of it.
Were there several chaps in the house, were there?
There would have been 4 or 5 FIDs, and they used to have people from the camp, which is the countryside in the Falklands, coming as well, staying there now. Just before Christmas, they have a racing carnival. It's a very important social event. And what happens is that there's heaps of people come in from the camp, and there was a big bedroom just opposite the room that I shared with 3 or 4 guys. And they used to, it was quite a large room, and they always filled it up totally with beds. There was no spaces between the beds. And so this room was, say, it was full of people. And anybody going into the far end had to step over and from one bed to another. Guest house itself, there was only one toilet and bathroom. There was no washhand basin. All it was a rack across the bath, and with a plastic bowl on it, and you fill that up and you sort of try to wash yourself in the best possible way. During this heavy use of the facilities there, I used to find Then I used to get up very early, about 5 o'clock, try and get in the bathroom so that at least you can get a wash and, you know, make sure that everything's all right. But there were no showers, nothing like that.
Was it an old house then, or...?
Oh, well, it was, yes. It was, but it was substantial, quite a big place.
Timber?
I would assume it probably was, yes.
What was Ma Brecken like?
Sort of like an Irish mother. Used to mother the boys a little bit. But it was a Catholic household. And the Monsignor used to come in and sit in the back in where the kitchen was and sort of have a chat with all the people. And so it was quite an interesting place.
Was she a widow?
Oh, no, I don't think... Yes, she... I think there was a husband somewhere. But there was certainly a son used to work on the British government was building some coal stores that was which was ill fated, never got used, and this fellow, the son, was worked on the building construction, and there was a lot of work needed with screwing things up, and he showed us how he used to do it, and in the hook of his sleeve on his coat, he had a claw hammer. He used to have a claw hammer in there, and he used to belt these screws in. It was much faster than doing it properly.
What do you remember about the weather readings you were recording at Stanley? I mean, the wind, I presume, was a major factor, was it?
Well, anyway, wind's always a problem in that part of the world. It always struck me that the weather in Stanley actually wasn't too bad. It's not severe climate, because it's a lot of sea around it. But it was always a problem with the small clouds would come over, which in this climate you would say it's fair weather cumulus.
Mm.
And this... In Port Stanley, what happens is that this lovely-looking cloud comes over, and then it rains, you know, which I always thought was odd.
That was only for a short time, because eventually you were then bundled off to Sydney.
A few months in there, and say it was a very interesting experience.
So what about Sydney? How did that strike you, your first real trip into the Antarctic?
Yes, Sydney was excellent. I knew nothing about dealing with snow or isolation or any of those things. And we spent an awful lot of time learning on the job, basically. And we did things like trying to train huskies and things. And we didn't know how to do it.
Mm.
And we had huge fights, which I remember one. There was a massive fight with these dogs. We couldn't do anything, and they were all on traces, and they were whining around our feet. And I felt a dog actually put his jaws around my my ankle, and I thought, oh, here goes. And he put his jaws around, and he instinctively knew it wasn't another dog, you know, and he took it off, and I think he was just knowing that if he'd have really bitten me, there would have been real trouble. Anyway, we sorted the things out, and we all became much more competent in doing these sorts of things later on. But Sydney was good, because we started off with there was seawater all around originally, and so we messed around in boats, and we did trips over to Coronation Island, which is the main island of that group. One trip we did, the unexpectedly the weather closed in and the temperatures plummeted, 10, 15 degrees, really just a huge difference. And when we slept overnight on the island, and the next morning we decided to get the dinghies organised to go back to Sydney, and there was a problem. The diesel mechanic who was in the party couldn't start the engines, and because they were too cold, and he messed around, and then we put the outboards inside a tent, try and warm it up, still wouldn't work. And he took it out again, poured petrol all over it, and set fire to it. and this, the next pull, the thing started, which utterly incredible. I don't know what we would have done, because we're halfway across the back on the boat, it's that little timber boat, ice started to cling to the side of the boat. And so we were there chipping the ice off up in the bows, trying to stop it from clinging to the boat. So that was an interesting sort of entry into the world of cold temperatures.
Did anything change after that experience? At that time they were kind of writing the rule books as they went along, really.
They were.
So was there more thought went into future trips because of that close call?
I don't know. There certainly wasn't in my experience, but who knows? Somebody might have passed it on. I really don't know. But it's the physics of it is simple. If you have cold temperatures and a cold sea, and you're running a boat across it, you're going to get catching onto the boat and sticking there.
Mm-hmm. It was a good winter, wasn't it, 57?
I was good, yes, excellent.
Were you doing much sledging?
We did quite a bit. The previous year had been a very bad year in terms of sea ice, and they were getting behind in their work of finishing off this survey they were doing. And so we were able to do a lot more the second year because we had the sledging. We had a couple of teams working, and it worked very well.
How did you take to the dogs and to sledging? Because that was new territory for you.
Oh, obviously. Absolutely, yes. The dogs were really I was going to say entertainment, not entertainment, but they were a joy to work with. Once you got them trained and they knew what you wanted, and you knew what they were capable of. It was really, a terrific experience. And then watching the puppies grow and playing with them, it relaxed everybody. And it was, in a way, a great shame that they took the dogs out, but you understand why.
Do you do much sledging then? Because generally speaking, meteorologists were somewhat tied to base, weren't they, on the whole?
They were, but there was four meteorologists on the team. By just juggling the shifts...
The rota you were drawing up.
Yeah, that's right. You could work it so that you could work quite happily for a few days or so with two people away.
Mm. Well, the other guys... as well trained as you, or had they done the crash course?
They'd done the crash course, and they were new to it as well, and so we had to sort of give them some extra training, as it were.
How are you getting the information about the weather out of Sydney? How are you transmitting it?
Well, it was the same on all bases. Once the reading was taken, it was put into a code, and this was then sent to Port Stanley. That was usually done when we were there, because it was the International Geophysical Year. That was done every 3 hours. And so it was a question of getting onto the radio listening for the call signs and repeat, you know, saying, well, I'm here. And Stanley would come back and say, right, go ahead. And then you'd transmit the code.
Why in 57 would you want to put the weather information into a secret code?
It's not a secret code. It's just a means of everybody working with the same set of data.
So it's a unified code?
Yes, everybody knows what the, you know, the third letter in that group over there means something.
Right.
It was the same with everybody.
So it's abbreviation, a code to
in a way, yes, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Were you aware much of the IGY? Did it impinge on your lives?
Well, the big factor was the we were doing these 3 hour observations, we were encouraged to do as many upper air balloons as possible, which was we were a part of the of that whole exercise. Only a small part, but we were there.
Did you think it was important to do that?
I think I did, yes.
Was there a sense of, because it was an international project, a sense of being part of something quite
It was a big exercise, and there was a lot of components in it, and say we were one of them.
And did you keep tabs on the transatlantic expedition?
It was pretty difficult to do that. There was no real means. We didn't have any radio contact with the expedition. The news broadcasts that we could listen to from that location really never mentioned the expedition, other than probably at the beginning and then at the end, and that was it.
Yeah. Were you happy on Cygni?
Oh, Cygni was terrific. It was a great sense of achievement. Everybody was willing and able, and one fellow had a bit of a problem, I think, but the base leader handled it very well.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the base leader was Cecil Scotland, who I was very pleased that he was there. I don't know the reason for this. It was never discussed. The main object was the harmony of the group. So we didn't inquire, and to this day I don't know why. It was a very strange exercise.
How did the base leader handle it?
I think he was very tolerant. I think I might have been throwing a few tantrums if one of my guys was doing things like that. But there's nothing you can do. You're stuck, you're there, and the harmony of the group is what it's all about.
So at the end of the season at Cygni, did you choose to move on, or were you asked to move on? What happened? If you're happy
there was with me on Cygni was Dave Statham and Stanley Black. They were two of my Met group,
right?
And the three of us we chatted about it, and we decided that we should really go to the real Antarctic, not this banana belt up in in Sydney. And we applied, and the three of us got the posting.
There was a rather interesting incident on the journey across, wasn't there? On board the Shackleton?
Oh, yes. When we left Sydney, there was... Well, firstly, the Shackleton came into the base, offloaded all the bits and pieces, and then I went aboard, and I was... I found a cabin on my own, and this was marvellous. I'd been sleeping in a bunk room with up to 14 other guys, with no windows open, and I don't know what we used for air, but it wasn't very good. And so to have the luxury of a wash-hand basin and a beautiful bunk, I thought this was marvellous. And anyway, the ship set sail. We had a bit of a party in the mess. I went to bed, and just before I went to bed, there was quite a big thump. The boat had obviously hit something that was perhaps a bit bigger than normal, but not totally unusual. And I went to bed, and the next thing I knew was about 2 or 3 in the morning, somebody came in and was shaking me. And the guy who's doing this was actually an American journalist who was doing a bit of a tour of FID's facilities. And he said, "The boat's sinking, get up." And I sort of jumped out of bed, and I suddenly realised that it was probably just as easy to walk on the wall as it was on the floor. There was a huge tilt of the boat. I got dressed quickly, put on my working gear for Antarctic, and raced up the stairs, came on the stern of the boat, came around the corner, and there was 2 lifeboats hanging on the divots above the water with the crew in them. So there was all these guys, the stewards and all the bits and pieces, all in the boats ready to launch. And they all had greatcoats on and suitcases. And I thought, this is the Antarctic. What are these blokes doing? How on earth are they going to survive? Anyway, I went forward, and I could see that there was a bit of activity, and then it was a question of trying to find out where the hole was. All the FIDs that were on board were all taking part in doing various things. The main thing was to find this hole, and there was people climbing through freezing water on the top of the cargo in the hold, trying to put some stuff into this gash that was on the side. The first officer said, what we've got to do is get some concrete, pour it into the thing, and what we need first is put a backing. So cut some timber so that it fits in between the ribs, and then pack it with the cement, quick drying cement behind it. And so a party of us went off and started to cut timber to a certain length, and then another group made this concrete. And then somebody went down the hole again and put the timber in place in very terrible conditions. It was very cold. And then they poured the concrete down behind.
Was the hole underwater at this point?
They, It was underwater, but only just.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next thing we knew was the pumps stopped. During the exercise, the pumps had been, there were two pumps pumping seawater out of the hold. And soon after the cement was put in, they stopped. And the engineers had a look at it, and they jammed up because of the sand in the cement. So there was no pumps. The boat was obviously still going lower and lower. The captain said, throw everything overboard that you possibly can, particularly the heavy stuff. So I spent the next couple of hours rolling 44-gallon drums of diesel. And I didn't realise diesel actually floats. There was this great track of drums floating away from the ship. But it was really not making... There was more water coming in. And anyway, there was... somebody must have used their brains, because what we were doing was total rubbish, really. Someone decided that we would use a crane that sits on top of the hold and lift a scow, a barge, up and fill the barge with as many heavy things as you can, which was ironic, seeing that we'd thrown everything we could overboard, and then winch it out, swing it out over to the other side of the boat. So the hull was on the port side, and so they swung the barge over to the starboard, and what that did was it tipped the ship. The ship actually rose, you know, so we changed the total tilt entirely. And of course what we were able to do then was to bring the hull out of the water, and that's what they did. And so basically that little exercise saved the day.
And they patched the hull once it was out of
With timber again, and they got some cloth material and put it behind. Now, that was okay. We'd stopped the boat from sinking imminently. But what the next thing was, we had to make contact. Nobody in the outside world knew this was going on.
No, you hadn't sent an SOS.
They had sent the SOSs. As soon as the event happened, the radio operator was going full pelt, but nobody was picking the signals up. Mm. And eventually, after two or three days, there was somebody in Europe got the signal, and then it all started to make, you know, there was an action plan to come and rescue us. HMS Protector finally arrived. The first boat that turned up was a little whale catcher who stood by us for 24 hours or so. When HMS Protector arrived, they sent a party overboard with a huge plate with bolts inside, and they fired these bolts through the hull, and it had like a gasket, and it sealed the thing entirely. And then we were transferred, everybody who could get off the boat, you know, didn't have a purpose to be there, was transferred to the HMS Protector.
Including you?
Including me. Now, once again, that was actually quite an exercise, let me tell you. Because the HMS Protector would not go behind an iceberg. The Navy was not going to put their boat at risk with an iceberg, whereas we were sheltered behind an iceberg. And so we went off with one of the lifeboats, something I'm trying to think of the word, lifeboats, to the protector. And when we got there, there was a huge sea running. And so you've got a big boat, which is relatively stable in the water, yet when the little boat comes alongside, you're doing this.
Up and down.
Up and down, up and down. And so the only way you could get somebody over onto the boat was one at a time. They stood somebody up in the bow. Somebody would hold their legs. And they would wait until the next wave came through. The fellow on the guiding the lifeboat would just gun the engine slightly. And it would come up to the rail of the protector. And up there was two burly marines, and they grabbed hold of you and just flung you over the rail. It's quite a little exercise. When we spent quite a few days on the protector, sleeping on the mess floor.
Where did it take you?
Well, firstly, we went to Port Stanley, to South Georgia, which sort of shadowed the boat and... I saw the shuttle.
Oh, the protector took accompanied. Yeah, that's right. South Georgia, the dry dock.
That's right. Yes, and I saw the boat in the dry dock and being welded. In fact, I got a little bit of film on it, and then we went back to from there to Stanley. I think we went back on the Shackleton to Stanley. I think. I'm
after
not sure.
Yeah.
I'd need to check.
That sounds about right. Mm. Yeah. So in the end, you ended up at Horseshoe.
Yeah, sure. Horseshoe was... it was actually quite an exercise getting down there. It went on and on and on. I transferred ships from the Shackleton to the John Biscoe. And we had a few little incidents on the way, but what happened was as we went further south, the John Biscoe was starting to have problems, getting stuck in the ice, and it really was no match for the quality of the ice that was there at that time. So what did they do? The usual thing, go and call in the Americans. And so the American icebreaker turned up, and they started to help us, and we gradually moved forward. But the ice got thicker and thicker, and it was more difficult to move. And what happened was as the American icebreaker moved forward, the Biscoe was meant to travel in the path that it created. But what happened was there was so much ice in there that the Biscoe didn't really have enough engine power to push it aside. Mm-hmm. And so somebody with a brilliant idea decided that what they would do was they'd tie a hawser from the icebreaker, the American ship, and put it around the front forecastle. In the front of the boat, anyway. And forecastle, so that's what the word I'm thinking of. And what happened then is then off we went. And the John Biscoe had never been through ice so fast in their life. but it became a problem, because what happened was that as the icebreaker was proceeding forward, the ice would be in patches would be a lot thicker, and it would slow the icebreaker, but coming up quickly behind was the John Biscoe, and they would have to put their engines in reverse to stop them hitting the icebreaker. Now, in one occasion which I witnessed was, as we proceeded forward, the icebreaker came almost to a sudden halt, and the John Biscoe was coming up behind, and they threw the thing in reverse, but it just simply wasn't enough, and we hit this icebreaker, great thump, and it was like a very large church bell with a clapper, and we were the clapper, and it hit this thing and it resonated the whole ship, and nothing happened for about 10-15 seconds, and then all of a sudden every outlet on that boat, there was Americans running out. Oh, it's the funniest thing I've seen. It was quite quite interesting.
It's one of those cases where the sound was worse than the reality.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, good. You got to Horseshoe. I'm moving you along a little bit. I want to spend some time on this.
Yeah, sure.
And this is well documented about the three men, two of whom you knew very well.
Yes.
Who went out onto the sea ice and were never seen again.
Mm.
What do you recall of the build-up to that incident? Was there any careful planning going on? Why were those
things changing? Yeah, okay. As I understand it, and I may not be totally correct here...
No, I just want your story.
Yeah, there had been a request from somewhere, I'm not sure where, but it had been a request to gather some emperor penguins' eggs at a certain time. And the timing was calculated to be at a certain date.
The embryonic development.
Yeah, that's right, yes. And so it was decided that if possible, we would try and, as an exercise, because we were all used to sledging and, you know, we were pretty familiar with the environment, we decided that we would try and see if we can go and get these eggs, basically. And so there was some planning done. There was people chosen, and
how were they chosen?
I think really the base leader made the decision. It was his decision on how he wanted to do it. It was reasonably well prepared. We knew that there was potential problems with sea ice. And the key component was that whatever happened while sledging, if there was any danger, then, you know, you were to think twice. But particularly at night camping, we wanted to make sure that it was all done on land, not sea ice, because sea ice was not as really a safe environment. The party set off. In a way, I was quite disappointed that I wasn't involved. I thought, well, it'll my turn next time. But but anyway, that
well,
was...
there were meant to be four men, weren't there? Ray McGowan didn't go. Obviously, there's only
there was three. Just as far as I'm aware, that there was just the three.
Yeah, there was a fourth man called Ray McGowan.
Yeah, Ray McGowan, yes, sir.
Who was due to go but didn't.
Well, I'm.
Or was he part of the original three?
No. I think I don't think he was considered, to be honest. So I may be wrong. It never occurred to me that he would be, because I'm not sure what his sledging experience was. But anyway, I'm not sure.
That's
on that
right.
point.
That's okay. So the three chaps went off.
Yes, they went off, and They went. So we didn't hear from them the first day. There was a reason for not doing a sked. And the next sked we tried, we didn't get anything at all. Now, there was then this huge storm that appeared, and it was a basically airflow from the mountains coming down through the fjords, and you can get very strong winds, and it's basically shifted out the ice that projected out from the end of the fjord. And so it was, we were astonished.
By the weather?
But well, yeah, by the when it started to calm down, we could get out. We were astonished that the actual sea ice had moved, because the sea ice actually was quite solid. I mean, it looked good, which particularly where we were. Now, it may have deteriorated further out, but certainly in the ice that we'd been working with, it looked quite good. So that was quite a surprise. But we felt reasonably confident at that point that the guys would have been, you know, they would have been aware of this, and they would have been sleeping, you know, hopefully on land, which was only the only safe thing to do if in that environment.
Did you never hear from them prior to that storm? You didn't get any radio signal back from them at all?
No.
So the moment
there was actually a reason for not doing it the first day.
Right.
And I think it was to do with the BBC's broadcast, because for some reason or other, the skeds all get timed when the broadcast is on. And the broadcast was a like a social event, if you like.
Is this calling Antarctica?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, so you could ask them to play certain music now, but they'd only play the ones they wanted.
Hasn't changed.
Yes.
Okay, so the sea ice blew out, and you'd rather hope the men had made it to dry land. When was it becoming apparent that may not have been the case?
Well, when we, the three of us, the remaining three, walked to the end of the fjord, and we had a look at this huge expanse of water in front of us, and I thought, my God. And it was flat calm. We were there, absolutely. It was just like a sheet of glass. And I remember we stood on the edge of the rocks there, and we discussed about how far sound could travel over still water. And so we stood on the edge of the rocks, shouting in unison, like trying to attract attention, and flashing lights and various things. Of course, it was all dark. This is one of the problems. When this was happening, there was only a couple of hours of really useful daylight. And you can imagine how what a dampener that put on everything, and everybody was, you know, very low, I guess is a good word. Anyway, we were there. We had to live and carry on, and we were there for a purpose. And, you know, we basically got on with it.
Tell me about the men you knew. You knew Statham and Black, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yeah. I'd only ever met them prior to that in Sydney.
Yeah, but you'd worked with them at Sydney?
Oh, yes.
What kind of guys were they?
Dave Statham was good jolly fellow, you know. He part of his he'd been in the National Service, and he'd been involved in taking explosives out of shells and things like that. So you sit in a on your own in a compound somewhere, taking the all the
diffusing bombs.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it was which I always thought was a very brave thing to do. But he was, say, a good, cheerful guy. And I was, he was great, great mate. Stan Black, very similar in a way. We all used to tease each other. And Stan was a tremendous cook. He would make eclairs and things like that, which used to last about 10 seconds. He'd slave away all morning and have it all demolished within seconds.
Mm-hmm. Was there any rescue attempt or recovery attempt?
Well, once the assessment had been made that the chances of these guys coming back was not going to be there, there was then a question of thinking that maybe they were stranded on an island or a rock heading somewhere. And so it was decided when it was safe that the sea ice had re-established itself, that we would get some search parties organised. Now, at Stonington, which is a base south of us, they were doing survey work, and they put all that aside, and a couple of guys came from there, and from Base W, which was in north of us, they sent some guys, and also some help with the weather system stuff as well, the observing. Mm-hmm. Because we were just two of us trying to run the whole thing, do all the other chores as well, look after the dogs.
Oh, so they sent in relief men to help you?
They did, yeah. And they swapped over for, every now and then. And so it was very good that they did that. Anyway, the one night, there was a bit of a commotion I heard, because I by that stage I was given the job of looking after the dogs. And there was a bit of commotion, and I went out and had a look. And lo and behold, it was one of the dogs that the fellows had been using. And virtually all the dogs, other than I think it was two or three, all eventually turned up one way or another. And they all were in pretty good condition. We weighed them, and they were all, they hadn't gone short of anything, let's put it that way.
What was the state of their leather tethers or leads?
It varied a good bit. Some had been chewed out, and whether there was any rhyme or reason to it, I don't know. But there was, say, it did tend to vary. I think some turned up with nothing at all, and others still had the part of the harness on. But it's not uncommon for dogs to chew their way out if they get stuck.
If they chewed their way through their leads, and that suggests that they had some time, doesn't it?
It does. You can think of any, there's so many scenarios you can think of that, nobody really knows. Nobody knows. And it's,
I've heard references to the fact that some of the traces have been cut with a knife. Did you spot that?
I don't particularly remember that. Just the way it happened, it could be that a dog chewing could still You know, they're pretty strong. But it's possible. It could have been with a knife. Could be.
Peter Gibbs, who was the bass leader at Stonington, and I've forgotten the name of the bass leader at Horseshoe for a moment.
It was John Paisley.
Yeah. They went out, didn't they, looking for this chap?
Yeah, there was, say, a number of search parties out, but they did a very difficult one, which was out to the Dedeon Islands in quite difficult circumstances, and the theory being is that the guys could have got to this island where the penguins were, and still be stranded on it, and so we wanted to make sure that didn't happen. You know, that there was if they were stranded, then we needed to find them. And say they went out on a difficult job, and I think those two guys are pretty well heroes, let me tell you, because it was very difficult circumstances. They covered a lot of ground, did quickly, and Peter Gibbs is a superb leader of running dog teams and things, and you couldn't have had two better guys doing that job.
There's also reference in Fuchs's book Ice and Men to Paisley having kind of almost a premonition about all this, or a vision. Do you have any memory of that?
I only recently found out this. I got the page of the book. I haven't read the book, so I got a that page where it mentioned that, and I know Paisley used to go off occasionally talking about things like this, and I used to laugh my head off and tell him you're crazy, and really, so he didn't really confide too much in me, because he didn't get much of a reaction. And really, that's it. I didn't put any store at all with any of that.
Apart from having to pick up their duties and other men being drafted in what way do you think it affected your experience of the Antarctic? I mean, most people say it was the best time of their lives, and I guess you agree.
Yeah, I had a terrific time there. I wouldn't have missed it for quids. The fact that this event happened on the second year was a tragedy, but I can't really let it colour my overall view of it. I really enjoyed being in the Antarctic. The things I did were fantastic. Think It broadened my outlook on life, and I'm pleased it happened. But when I got back to England, and I was offered a job in meteorology in Jersey again, and also I was offered a job to come down with FIDS again. They were looking for experienced people, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to, I can't keep on doing this. It is something, there's a life beyond this, and so I decided to change direction entirely, and say became involved in the commercial world, if you like, and I met my wife and married and all the usual stuff, and I'm very pleased we did that.
So after the incident, you had to take over some other responsibilities on Horseshoe Island, in particular.
Yes.
You did some mechanical work, didn't you, and also working with the dogs.
Yes, I'd been involved with the dogs there, from helping out, and so I was used to dealing with the dogs anyway. Yeah.
And the mechanical work, you had some limited experience of that as well?
Yeah, well, we got there was two diesel engines. One was pretty bad, and the other one was starting to play up as well, and so it was very important that we try and keep these things going, because if you really want to have a tragedy, to get, you know, lose your diesel engine, that's really becomes difficult. So I would appear between the three of us who were left, I had the most experience of dealing with mechanical things, because you know, I played around with motorbikes, so that was, I got the job. I mean, I'm not complaining. I enjoyed it. In fact, we made a little team, pup team, which went on later on to become a recognised team.
Called?
I don't know.
Okay, don't worry.
Somebody else asked me that once. I simply don't know. I never.
Did you, when you got back to the UK, did you go and find any of the families of the lost men?
When I arrived in Southampton, I thought it would be good that I go and see the families, because I was really concerned that they were, you know, the missing their loved ones. So I went and talked to senior people from FIDS and said, what do you think I ought to do? And it was Ray Ady, who was a geologist in charge of the geology section. And he said it would be stirring up old memories, and it would, in fact, be kinder not to go and see them. So I thought, well, you know, maybe this fellow's knows what he's talking about. And so I didn't go and see them.
How do you feel about that now?
I've always felt that it was not really the right thing to do, but I took the advice from the, you know,
senior man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What do you do? It's a
I'd like to finish. There's a very strange note here, a different note altogether, about the case of the multiple circumcisions.
Oh,
and researcher
right.
Amanda has written in rather large red letters, what do you mean by that?
Okay.
Finish on a high note.
Right.
Or a low note.
Oh, yeah. when we were leaving Horseshoe in early 59... there was the usual business. The Bisco couldn't get into the base, so they had to call in the Americans. The Americans had been on long term duty out. They'd been something like 6, 7, 8 months away from a port, and so they were getting pretty chewy. And then these POMs keep on asking them to come back and dig them out of a hole. So, icebreaker went as far as it could to base Y, and it couldn't go any further. So they sent in helicopters and picked us up, and took us back to the ship. To the Bisco, dropped us on the Bisco. And so we were all stuck there. One of the things is the icebreaker was running out of fuel. So they had to actually go and call in another icebreaker, which took quite a few days to get to the area. And so what happened was that the American captain invited us to the equivalent of a wardroom in the mess, officers' mess, for drinks. Now, Now, the thing is that the drinks were actually coffee because it was a dry ship. The blood just used to come over onto our ship and drink our beer. Anyway, where we was ushered into this wardroom, into the mess, and there was all these officers were dressed up in their whites and things, and there was waiters going around with trays and things like that. And we were all sort of having a bit of a chat to the various officers. And one of the officers, who was the chief engineer on the ship, said to Henry Wyatt, who was one of the guys, and Peter Gibbs was there, and John Paisley, and he said, "What do you do?" And Henry said, "I'm a doctor." And he said, "You're a doctor." He said, "Would you give me your professional opinion on my circumcision?" And without batting an eyelid, he opened the front of his trousers and brought out the offending flesh, or the lack of the flesh.
Member.
Yes.
Yeah.
And said to Henry, what do you think of this? Now, Henry was, he was one of these doctors who would have waistcoats on and things, you know. He was on a fob watch. And I don't think he'd done really much work on a three-week-old circumcision. And so we said, "Why have you done this? Why now?" And he said, "Well, look, I'm age 40. He said, "I've spent 40 years with a foreskin, and I'm going to now spend probably another 40 years without one. And I want to see what the difference is." And he said, "But look, come with me." And so we trooped through the ship to their injury room or
first aid room.
First aid. And it was quite a large room with a whole series of bunks, three bunks high, going back quite a way. And this was all full of blokes lying on their backs. And he said, "These fellas have all been circumcised." And he said,
"Recently?"
On the ship. And we said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, these guys, we haven't been in a port for 6, 7, 8 months or whatever. And they're getting stir crazy. And they're doing chores every day. And if they get circumcised, they'll get 3 weeks off. Off duties." And so these fellas had decided that they would not go and, you know, they missed out on doing all these nasty chores. Very odd. And one of the favourite games of the other sailors who were doing the chores was to pass girly magazines to these fellas to inflict as much pain as possible.
Had Wyatt seen anything like that before?
I doubt it. It's not really a common thing I don't know how many people there were, but there would be. You know, probably a dozen people who were in that first aid area.
Sick bay.
That's the phrase. Yes.
All none of whom had a foreskin anymore.
That's right. I just wondered what the chief engineer, which part of his life he preferred. Which.
Thank you for that. That's a story I've never heard before, David.
It all happened, I assure you.
Thank you very much indeed. I think the canteen is beckoning.
Oh, yes.
That's been great. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.